is. Generally, people will be people, so which way we head will largely be determined by politics and by technology. At least in one regard, the stuff factor, so to speak, technology is already driving a tremendous and positive change, a global process of dematerialization that has replaced billions of tons of goods with digital products and human services. Thus it is that wall-to-wall shelves dedicated to records and compact discs have been replaced by streaming music services. People who once needed vehicles for once-in-a-while travel now open an app on their phones to request a ride share, and entire wings of hospitals once used for storing patients' records have been supplanted by handheld cloud-connected tablet computers. As Steven Pinker has pointed out, a lot of the time, energy, and money we once spent on making stuff is now directed towards cleaner air, safer cars, and drugs for orphan diseases. Meanwhile, the experiences, not things movement and the like, are transforming the ways in which we save and spend money, and leaving us with less crap in our basements. After a century of movement towards McMansions, the latter half of the 2010s saw a significant drop in the square footage of new homes and increasing demand for smaller apartments, continuing a centuries-long migration from farm-based rural living to smaller, shared urban spaces. As the global success of WeWork proves, today's young adults are not only comfortable with much smaller working and living quarters, with shared community spaces such as offices, kitchens, gyms, laundries, and lounges, but increasingly are demanding them. The slow death of stuff is not the end of consumption, though. We're as addicted as ever to wasting food, water, and energy. As it stands, the United Nations has warned, we are polluting water far faster than nature can recycle and purify it. We literally throw away half of the world's edible food each year, more than a billion tons of it, even as millions of people are left hungry or malnourished. At the current pace of population growth and economic mobility, the United Nations estimates by 2050 it will take the equivalent of nearly three of our planet's resources to sustain our lifestyles for 1 year. Yet the United Nations spends surprisingly little time debating consumption, let alone forging international agreements that would help build a world in which no society consumes more than its share of what the Earth can produce under contemporary technological conditions. That last part is important. Just as it is helping us reduce our stuff addiction, technology absolutely has to play a role in solving these other consumption problems. For there is no free nation in the world that can unilaterally force its citizens to consume less while others on the planet consume more. Laws can encourage businesses to conform, but we also have to make it attractive and easy for individuals to consume less. Therefore, we must invest in research that allows us to grow more healthy food and transport it more effectively. And please make no mistake, that includes accepting genetically modified crops, those engineered to include a trait in the plant that doesn't occur in its wild form, such as resistance to insects, tolerance to drought, greater vitamin A production, or more efficient use of sunlight to convert CO2 to sugar, as an absolutely necessary part of our food future. With more efficient plants, we could feed up to 200 million additional people just from plants grown in the US Midwest. These crops have gotten a bad rap for being unnatural, although many people who hold this view don't recognize that most of the food we think of as natural has already been subject to significant genetic manipulation. The ears of corn you see at the grocery store look nothing like the wild plant from which the modern corn came. Over the course of 9,000 years, the spindly, finger-length grass known as teosinte was cultivated to evolve larger cobs and more rows of plump, soft, sugary kernels, a process of modification that significantly altered the plant's genome. The apples we've grown accustomed to eating have a bit more resemblance to their small wild ancestors, but good luck finding one of those ancestors. They have been nearly wiped off the planet, and that's no great loss to our diet, since the biggest genetic contributor to modern apples, Malus sylvestris, is so tart it's darn near inedible. In 2016, the National Academy of Sciences, in a sweeping report on genetically engineered crops, noted that lab-modified plants could be vital for feeding the planet's growing human population if global warming threatens traditional farm products. And since numerous other reports over the past few decades had not been enough to assuage continuing public concern, the report's authors once again reaffirmed the Academy's position that GMO crops are safe for both human consumption and the environment. There is nothing wrong with skepticism, but after thousands of studies, the evidence is irrefutable. If you believe that climate change is a threat, you can't say that GMOs are, because the evidence that GMOs are safe is stronger than the evidence that climate change is occurring. The World Health Organization, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and the American Medical Association have also affirmed that, as WHO puts it, no effects on human health have been shown as a result of the consumption of such foods by the general population. Moreover, these foods could be vital to meeting the challenge of feeding the billions of people who are already going hungry in our world and the additional billions who will be joining us on this planet in coming years. If we are to feed the world now and in the future, we need to embrace safe new technologies. According to UNICEF, up to 2 million deaths each year could be prevented if poor families had access to more vitamin A in their diets in crops that are perfectly safe. Vitamin A supplements aren't working as well as is needed. Between 2015 and 2016, vitamin A supplementation coverage dropped by more than half in the 5 countries with the highest child mortality rates. An open letter signed by more than 100 Nobel Prize winners called on governments to approve genetically modified organisms. How many poor people in the world must die before we consider this a crime against humanity? They asked. We could feed a billion more people with more nutritional food. With climate change, we may have no choice. To decrease the impact of humans, there's also a tremendous need to figure out how to satiate the global demand for protein without the tremendous environmental costs of farmed animal meat. Made with 99% less water, 93% less land, and 90% fewer greenhouse gases, innovations that are giving us damn near close to meat products, with plant leg hemoglobin that bleeds and some good old-fashioned mad science, are booming and will need to continue to boom if we are to feed our appetite for tasty protein without further degrading our planet. There's no question that one of the greatest technological advances in this century has been the discovery of precise, programmable genome editing. As with most other breakthroughs, there were dozens of brilliant people involved in the lead-up to it, but Emmanuel Charpentier, then at the Laboratory for Molecular Infection Medicine in Sweden, and Jennifer Doudna at UC Berkeley, have garnered the most fame for their remarkable discovery that the bacterial Cas9 protein is a DNA cutting enzyme with an RNA-based GPS or guide. The next year, Feng Zhang at MIT and George Church at Harvard proved that the system could be used to edit human cells. They too garnered fame and some very valuable patents. News of the discovery spread quickly down the hall to my lab. It seemed too good to be true, except it was. The technology is colloquially known as CRISPR, for clustered, regularly interspaced, short palindromic repeats, which are the natural DNA targets of Cas9 cutting in bacteria. Cas9, and now dozens of other DNA editing enzymes from other bacteria, can alter plant genes with accuracy without using any foreign DNA. They can create exactly the same kind of alterations that occur naturally. Using CRISPR is far more natural than bombarding seeds with radiation, a treatment that is not banned. That's why the decision by the Court of Justice of the European Union in 2018 was so unexpected and upsetting to the United States. The court ruled in favor of Confédération Paysanne, a French agricultural union that defends the interests of small-scale farming and 8 other groups to ban CRISPR-made foods. The ruling defies science. It bans healthy foods that could relieve the environmental burden, increase the health of the poor, and allow Europe to cope better with global warming. The ruling also scared developing nations away from CRISPR-modified crops. There they could make a positive impact both on people's lives and on their land. The text of the ruling makes it clear that it was not a decision to protect consumers from the dangers of GMO. It was part of a global trade war to prevent US patented products from entering the European Union. The US Secretary of Agriculture, Sonny Perdue, made this abundantly clear in his response. Government policies should encourage scientific innovation without creating unnecessary barriers or unjustifiably stigmatizing new technologies. Unfortunately, this week's ECJ ruling is a setback in this regard, in that it narrowly considers newer genome editing methods to be within the scope of the European Union's regressive and outdated regulations governing genetically modified organisms. Of course, nations should be able to help local farmers whose livelihoods are threatened, but there are other ways to do that. It's ultimately hurtful to everyone on the planet to use the cover of dangerous science to justify trade restrictions, especially to those who need the new technologies most. We also need to solve the shortage of fresh, drinkable water. Cities such as Las Vegas, a very thirsty town in the middle of the driest place in the United States, have demonstrated that by marrying conservation and innovation, efficient water recycling is not only possible, but profitable. Whereas Metro Vegas grew by 500,000 people from 2000 to 2016, its total water use fell by a third. We often adopt new technologies way too slowly, but when we finally do, they can solve some of our biggest problems. It was back in 1962 that scientist Nick Holonyak Jr. created the first practical visible light-emitting diode. At General Electric, they called it the magic one. It took another half century to develop an LED house bulb, and even then, many US consumers revolted, preferring to slow the phase-out of incandescent bulbs even as other nations moved forward with the LED revolution. Eventually, a combination of tax incentives and laws that outlawed the Edison light bulb forced the adoption of LED lighting. Today, LED lights used 75% less energy than incandescent lighting and last 50 times as long, which in a typical home is about 2 decades. Widespread use of LEDs in the United States is set to save the equivalent of the annual output of 44 large electric power plants, saving about $30 billion a year. To put this into perspective, that money could double the budget of the National Institutes of Health and set 40,000 scientists to work on life-saving medicines. Human ingenuity is not a zero-sum game. Longer, healthier lives will do us little good if we consume ourselves into oblivion. The imperative is clear. Whether or not we increase human longevity, our survival depends on consuming less, innovating more, and bringing balance to our relationship with the bounty of our natural world. That might seem like a tall order. Indeed, it is a tall order. But I believe we can stand tall and together to meet it. In many ways, we are already doing so. At the 2018 Global Climate Action Summit, for instance, it was announced that 27 cities had reached peak emission levels. A peak, not a plateau. All of those places were seeing steep emission declines. Among that group of cities was Los Angeles, which was once definable by its ubiquitous smog. It had cut its emissions by 11% in 1 year. Yes, there are more people than ever in the cities of North America, South America, Europe, and Asia. But today, the impact of each human in those regions is declining. We're rapidly moving from petroleum to natural gas, solar power, and electricity. When I first visited Bangkok, I experienced respiratory distress. Now, more days than not, there is blue sky. When I arrived in Boston in 1995, a splash of water from the harbor could land you in hospital or in the grave. Now it is safe for swimming. The same is true of Sydney Harbour, the Rhine River, and the Great Lakes. Going backward or even staying put is not a viable solution to the current crisis. The only path forward is one in which we embrace human capital and ingenuity. One of the best examples comes from a tiny town in South Australia. After the closure of the last coal-fired power station in the state in 2016, investors built Sundrop Farms on the barren coast, then hired 175 people who had recently become unemployed. The farm uses free energy from the sun and seawater to make 180 Olympic-sized swimming pools worth of fresh water per year, an effort that in the past would have burned 1 million gallons of diesel fuel. Today, 33,000 pounds of fresh organic tomatoes are shipped each year from the port where coal used to come in. Sundrop is an example of a Schumpeterian gale of creative destruction, the type of technological paradigm shift we will need to usher in the age of longevity and prosperity. For this to happen, we need more visionary scientists, engineers, and investors. We need more smart legislation to speed, not impede, the adoption of earth-saving technologies. This will free up money and human capital that are currently wasted. The freed-up money needs to be reinvested in people and technologies, not in meaningless stuff, to ensure that humanity and the earth endure, indeed thrive, together. We need to rethink the way we work. The University of Pennsylvania was a wonderful school at which to study theology and the classics. It had recently launched a medical school too. As a native Philadelphian, Joseph Wharton was proud of the local college, but the millionaire industrialist also believed the university was missing something essential. With industry now powered by steam and steel, we can no longer rely on apprenticeship alone to create future generations versed in business, he wrote to friends and associates on December 6, 1880, just months before officially opening the world's first business college, the Wharton School. There needs to be institutions to instill a sense of the coming strife of the business life and of the immense swings upward or downward that await the incompetent soldier in this modern strife. But Wharton could scarcely have predicted the extent of the strife that was on the horizon. A nascent labor movement in Europe would soon go global, bringing with it revolutionary changes in workers' rights. Among those changes was something that had never existed in the history of labor: the weekend. We tend to take the 5-day work week as a given, but it's an exceptionally recent innovation. It didn't exist as a concept or even a phrase until the late 1800s. The same can be said of legal limits on daily working hours, the abolition of child labor, medical benefits, and health and safety regulations. All of this was a response to the needs and demands of labor, and indeed the best interests of business owners such as Wharton. The global Schumpeterian transformation now at hand will reshape the world as profoundly as the Industrial Revolution. Every business school in the world should be preparing its students for what is coming, and labor advocates should be doing the same. The idea of connecting retirement to a person's chronological age will be an anachronism soon enough. And just like Social Security, the structures that support labor pensions will need to be reevaluated. Skillbaticals, which might take the shape of a government-supported paid year off for every 10 worked, might ultimately become cultural and even legal requisites, just as many of the labor innovations of the 20th century have. In this way, those who are tired of working harder would be afforded every opportunity to work smarter by returning to school or a vocational training program paid for by employers or the government, a variation of the universal basic income that is being discussed in the United States and some countries in Europe. Meanwhile, those who believe they are happy and secure in their careers can enjoy what has come to be known as a mini-retirement, a year off to travel, learn a language or musical instrument, volunteer, or refresh and reconsider the ways in which they are spending their lives. This is not a particularly crazy scheme. Sabbatical leave is common in higher education. Yet an idea like this might seem ridiculous to those who only consider the way the world works today. Who would pay for such a benefit? How will companies retain workers in the long term without the promise of a gold watch retirement plan at the end of decades of service? But whoever engages in this discussion now will have the upper hand when we decide how to redistribute the resources freed up by the elimination of ever-skyrocketing insurance premiums and pyramid scheme pensions. Yet few business professors are so much as thinking about this coming change, and even fewer courses are being taught on the subject in places such as the Wharton School. Labour leaders, meanwhile, are locked in an understandable but ultimately futile fight for retirement and benefits for workers who, in the past, would have laboured for 40 or 50 years, retired for a short spell, and then rather promptly died. Almost no one is fighting over what the world of work will look like when age is truly nothing more than a number. But that era is coming, and it is coming sooner than most people and institutions realize. We need to get ready to meet our great-great-grandkids. I sure am glad I won't be around when that happens. I hear this a lot, mostly it seems, from people who are in or soon approaching retirement. These are folks who have already decided that their lives are going to end in the next couple of decades. They're certainly hoping to stay healthy during that time and maybe eke out a few extra good years if they can, but they don't think they're going to be around for much longer than that. To them, the middle of this century might as well be the next millennium. It's not on their radar. And that's the world's biggest problem. The future is seen as someone else's concern. In part, this stems from our relationship to the past. Very few of us had the opportunity to get to know our great-grandparents. Many of us don't even know their names. That relationship is an abstraction, and so most of us don't think about our great-grandkids as much more than a fuzzy, abstract idea. Sure, we care about the world our children will live in because we love our children, but the conventional wisdom about aging and death tells us they'll be gone a few decades after we are. And yes, we care about our grandkids, but by the time they come around, we're often so close to the exit that it doesn't seem as though there's much we can do about their future anyway. This is what I want to change, more than anything else in the world. I want everyone to expect that they will meet not only their grandchildren, but their great-grandchildren and their great-great-grandchildren. Generations upon generations living together, working together, and making decisions together. We will be accountable in this life for the decisions we made in the past that will impact the future. We'll have to look at our family members, friends, and neighbors in the eye and account for the way we lived before they came along. That, more than anything else, is how our understanding of aging and inevitable prolonged vitality is going to change the world. It will compel us to confront challenges that we currently push down the road, to invest in research that won't just benefit us now, but people 100 years from now, to worry about the planet's ecosystems and climate 200 years from now, to make the changes we need to make to ensure the rich don't enjoy an increasingly lavish way of life while the middle class begins to tumble towards poverty, to ensure that new leaders have a fair and legitimate opportunity to displace old ones, to bring our consumption and waste into balance with what the world can sustain today and many centuries into the future. This isn't going to be easy. The challenges are vast. We are not only going to have to touch the third rail of politics, social security, but to douse ourselves in water and lie down upon it, adjusting our expectations about work, retirement, and who deserves what and when. We're no longer going to be able to wait for prejudiced people to die. We're going to have to confront them and work to soften their hearts and change their minds. We can't just allow the Anthropocene extinction to continue at a rate thousands of times higher than the natural rate. We need to slow it dramatically and, if we can, stop it altogether. To build the next century, we're going to have to figure out where everyone is going to live, how they're going to live, under what rules they're going to live. We're going to have to ensure that the vast social and economic dividends we receive from prolonging people's lives are spent wisely. We're going to have to be more empathetic, more compassionate, more forgiving, and more just. My friends, we're going to have to be more human. I really love that chapter.
I do too. I love the way it ends with this call to be more human. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that within all of us, there's a lot of good. Often we don't tap into it. But I'm a humanist. What that means is I truly believe that humans can be a great force for good and not evil. But I think if we're going to get to this future that we've described in the book, we're all going to have to be the best people we can possibly be.
You know, there are a lot of calls to action in that chapter. You want people to rethink the way we work. You want us to reconsider the way we die. You want us to totally reconsider the way we do medical care. And there's more than that, too. It's a lot. Where should people start?
Well, I think with their everyday lives, just being a good person, caring about others, doing what's right, helping others out, donating money to causes. If we all did that, of course, the world would be an incredibly wonderful place. What my life is based on is the concept that we can do better. And I grew up as a kid thinking there's probably an alien species watching us on planet Earth. And we have a little scene in the book that, Matt, you put nicely on the page, where they're judging us. We're being judged as a species, whether we deserve to be in the club of advanced civilizations. And sometimes I'm just really embarrassed by our species, that we're just not doing what we could. You know, the voyage to the moon, getting men of our species on the moon, was something that I think would tick one of the boxes. Curing smallpox. These are the things that make our species great. But there's a lot of things we don't do well, and we get negative points for that. And I think if we were to, as a species, realize that aging is something we could work on, and if we put effort into it and actually allowed people to live healthier, longer lives, that would be a very big tick in a very big box. Conclusion. Let me take you on a tour of my lab at Harvard Medical School in Boston, Massachusetts. You'll find us in the genetics department in the new research building, arguably the best group of biologists in the world. That's the same place where Connie Sepko is working to grow mammalian eyes in a dish and studying the potential for gene therapy to restore lost vision. Down the hall in his clean room, David Reich, the author and scientist, is sequencing DNA from 20,000-year-old teeth and discovering that our ancestors liked to breed with other human subspecies. And a floor down, George Church is working on, among other wizardries, printing an entire human genome and reviving the woolly mammoth. Across the street, Jack Szostak has moved on from his Nobel Prize-winning work to uncover secrets about how life began 4 billion years ago. He comes by sometimes to visit. Yeah, the elevator conversations are awesome. My lab is on the 9th floor. The first person you'll see when you walk in the office is Susan DiStefano, who basically has kept our lab and my life under control for the past 14 years. Susan is a devout Christian who believes in the literal version of Genesis. She figures we are doing God's bidding by helping the sick and the needy. There's no reason why our views on God and science can't coincide. We both want to make the world a better place. To the left of Susan's doorway, you'll find lab manager Louis Rajman's office. Louis, who has a PhD in cellular and molecular biology, ran the transgenic mouse facility at the giant biotech company Biogen Idec. But when we first met, he was managing a high-end framing company. He's worked on paintings worth more than my house, and probably more than all my neighbors' houses together, too. So he's the right sort of guy for a job that requires exceptional meticulousness. Sitting with her back to Louis is Carolina Chovalik, who has a PhD in regenerative medicine and is our chief of staff, a strict but fair manager who makes sure our team of 30 to 40 scientists is funded and remains very much worth funding. Daniel Vera sits next to Louis and is usually staring at least one, often several, screens. He's the lab's data guru, having established Florida State University's Center for Genomics. I'll never forget the day he showed me the whole genome analysis of the epigenetic changes in the ice mice that helped reinforce the information theory of aging. Down the hall, past framed copies of research papers we've published, there's a sign above a door that says, Operations Room, as a nod to Winston Churchill's Central Command. Inside you'll find the lab and an ever-rotating group of some of the best minds in the world. When I took a walk through the lab one recent day, one of my favorite things to do, these were some of the characters who were there. On my left were Israel Pichardo Casas, a Mexican cell biologist, and Bogdan Budnik, a Ukrainian physicist, who have found more than 5,000 new human genes within non-coding junk DNA. These small genes make small proteins that course through our bloodstreams, any one of which could be a treatment to cure cancer, treat diabetes, or be the factor that allows young mice to rejuvenate the old. Then there were the Michaels, Bonkowski, Schultz, and Cooney. Bonkowski played a key role in our study on reversing vascular aging, making old mice run twice as far. He holds the record for the creation of the longest-lived mouse in scientific history at 5 years. Schultz, his mentee, is studying the molecular events that cause age-related inflammation, looking for ways to suppress that reaction and thus remove a key driver of age-aggravated diseases. He and Bonkowski are using gene therapy to infect old mice with longevity genes, aiming to break their own mouse longevity record. Cooney is working with NASA to introduce DNA repair genes from the super tough 8-legged micro creatures known as tardigrades into human cells in an effort to provide astronauts with protection from cosmic radiation and, of course, to slow aging. There was João Amorim from Portugal. He's studying resveratrol and a bunch of stacks in an effort to understand how they activate SIRT1 in the body. He's changed just one base pair in the mouse SIRT1 gene that makes the enzyme resistant to resveratrol and other stacks. He's testing if that mutant mouse still receives the health and lifespan benefits of resveratrol. If resveratrol no longer works on the mutant, then it should resolve the debate about whether resveratrol is working by directly activating the SIRT1 enzyme or via some other mechanism, like activating AMPK. So far, the results look promising for the SIRT1 activation hypothesis. There was Jae-hoon Young from South Korea. He has spent the past 6 years tickling the chromosomes of cells and animals to understand how and why the ice mice age prematurely. It was he and João who first showed that the epigenetic clock in the ice mice ticks faster. Next to him was Wenchen Lu, one of China's top students, who discovered the powerful epigenetic reprogramming system that can be delivered into aged animals via a modified virus. Xiao Tian had just used that virus to protect human nerve cells from chemotherapy. The normal nerves had either died or shrunk into a ball, but the reprogrammed ones were completely healthy, with long, beautiful cellular projections extending out across the floor of the Petri dish. Some experiments aren't very conclusive. This was night and day. We plan to test our virus in patients with eye disorders within a couple of years. Patrick Griffin, my most recent graduate student, wants to know if stimulating a response to DNA damage without creating actual DNA damage is sufficient to cause aging in mammals. To test this, he has designed a way to tether DNA damage signaling proteins to the genome using a non-cutting version of Cas9 CRISPR. If our theory is correct, he should still cause aging. Jamie Ross has engineered NICE mice to experience accelerated epigenomic noise just in neurons. She wants to know if the brain controls aging in the rest of the body, and if these mice operate more like 80-year-old humans. If so, they could be used as better models for human brain aging and possibly Alzheimer's disease. Joel Sohn has worked with some of the greatest biologists of the 20th century, then spent 30 years as a fisherman catching and exporting marine life, and is now searching the seas for secrets of immortality. He's studying cnidarians, transparent ocean animals that can do amazing tricks with their bodies, such as regrow a new body part or spawn a baby from their feet. That day was a good day for Joel. His decapitated sea anemone was regrowing a head, and his immortal jellyfish were budding off baby clones. Perhaps these regenerative processes are the same as the ones that allow us to regenerate optic nerves. Perhaps these creatures have access to the biological equivalent of Shannon's observer, the one who stores youthful epigenetic information. Abhirup Das, who spearheaded the Old Mouse Marathon Project, was studying the impact of precursors such as hydrogen sulfide and NMN on wound healing. Lindsay Wu, who also runs our labs in Sydney, Australia, at the University of New South Wales, was examining molecules that activate an enzyme called G6PD, which has been shown to extend the lifespans of multiple animals and, tragically, is mutated in 300 million people, the most common of all mutations. He has also restored fertility in old female mice by feeding them NMN and protecting their eggs from DNA damage. There was our resident dental student, Roxanne Bavarian, who is working to identify the role of sirtuins on oral toxicities and cancer. And there was Kaisa Selezniemi from Finland, who is one of the world's leading experts on culturing stem cells from ovaries and reversing female infertility. Parvez Mohammed from India was creating new chemicals in the fume hood, and Conrad Rinaldi was testing if the latest batch worked to rejuvenate skin cells from aged people. Giuseppe Coppetelli from Italy was examining new human longevity genes we'd discovered, including one called Copine 2 that is mutated in Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease patients. Alice Kane, an Australian, was examining some mice to develop a mouse frailty clock to predict how long a mouse will live, and is helping all of us see and appreciate sex differences. June Lee, our lab's senior biochemist, was investigating why our ability to repair DNA goes down with age and has found that NMN reverses the process. And those were just the people who were in the lab on that specific day. There are others, a lot of them, who are doing world-changing work. These people are brilliant. They could be working on answering any question in the universe, but they've come to Harvard to work on aging. Some of them are introverts, as scientists often are. A few are cautious, conservative researchers, a trait I'm working to fix. Yet there isn't a single one who doesn't believe that prolonged human vitality is on its way. And this is just one lab. There are three more labs in the Paul F. Glenn Center for the Biology of Aging at Harvard that are focused on helping people live longer and healthier lives. At Bruce Yankner's lab, they're exploring the impact of aging specifically on the human brain. Marsha Higgis's lab is investigating the role that mitochondria play in aging and disease, and has uncovered the role of sirtuin mutations in cancer. Amy Wager's lab was one of the first to show the blood of young mice rejuvenates the old, and vice versa, prompting people to infuse themselves with serum from young donors. Amy and I are collaborating to find the factors in the blood and develop new advanced pharmaceuticals to treat age-related diseases without the creepiness. At another Glenn Center, just across the river at MIT, Lenny Gorenti, Angelica Amon, and Li-Wei Tsai are all working on fundamental questions related to slowing, stopping, and reversing aging. In other cities in the United States, Thomas Rando, Anne Brunet, Tony Weiss-Corre, Elizabeth Blackburn, Nir Barzilai, Rich Miller, and others are all running large labs or centers aimed at changing the way we think about aging. North of San Francisco, there is an entire building called the Buck Institute for Research on Aging, completely devoted to understanding and combating aging. The list goes on and on. Those are just a few of the labs. Around the world, more than a dozen independent research centers are working hard on these same questions, and there is now at least one scientist in every major university in the world who is working on aging. Most of these labs obtain their research grants for other diseases, but increasingly are turning their attention toward understanding aging, reasoning that fixing that problem will fix whatever disease they're funded to fight. This is, after all, an environment in which a huge source of research funding is off limits for those who are fighting something that most people believe is inevitable and few people recognize is a disease. Meanwhile, private enterprise is leading the way in the development of neural net-based initiatives for drug discovery and development, gene analysis, biotracking, and disease detection to dramatically extend our lives. And every day, research into the simple things anyone can do to prolong their lifespans and health spans is mounting too, offering better and better maps to good health and long lives. A decade or two ago, when even the most optimistic scientists were only just beginning to envision a world in which aging wasn't inevitable, and when there were only a handful of researchers in the world specifically working to slow, stop, or reverse aging, I certainly could understand when people listened politely about my work and then gave me a look as though I were crazy. Today, I have a hard time understanding how anyone could look at this vast and brilliant army of researchers and not believe that a tremendous change in human aging is coming, and soon. I have some compassion for those who say, it can't be done. They are, in my view, the same kind of people who said vaccines couldn't work and humans couldn't fly. But given the benefits that longevity research can bring to the world, I have far less patience, indeed really none at all, for those who say it shouldn't be done. Beyond belief. There are those who would have you believe that the people in my lab, and those like them in labs around the world, are engaged in an unnatural and even immoral campaign to change what it means to be human. That view is rooted in ideas about human nature that might charitably be described as subjective, but that are probably more accurately called zealotry. That, it seems to me, was the guiding force behind a 2003 report submitted to the White House by the President's Council on Bioethics titled Beyond Therapy, Biotechnology and the Pursuit of Happiness, which ominously warned against aging research because it goes against the human grain and violates the purportedly orderly cycle of birth, marriage, and death. The council wondered, would people be more or less inclined to swear lifelong fidelity until death do us part if their life expectancy at the time of marriage were 80 or 100 more years rather than, as today, 50? What kind of unhappy marriages, I wondered in return, would drive people to even ask such a question? I would love to have an extra 50 years with my wife, Sandra. Aging, the council proffered, is a process that mediates our passage through life, and that gives shape to our sense of the passage of time. Without it, the council's members cautioned, we could become unhinged from the life cycle. Our so-called natural life cycle, of course, is one in which the vast majority of our ancestors never got old enough to get grey hair or wrinkles, and in which consumption by carnivore was a perfectly ordinary way to go. If you'd like to be hinged to that, be my guest. Might we be cheating ourselves, the council asked, by departing from the contour and constraint of natural life, our frailty and finitude, which serve as a lens for a larger vision that might give all of life coherence and sustaining significance? Oh, for goodness sake, if we truly believed that frailty was a requisite for a meaningful life, we'd never mend a broken bone, vaccinate against polio, or encourage women to stave off osteoporosis by maintaining adequate calcium levels and exercising. I know I shouldn't get worked up about these sorts of things. It's a tale as old as science, after all. Just ask Galileo what happens when you disrupt the natural order of things. But this was more than a trifling report from moralizing bureaucrats. The chair of the committee that wrote it, Leon Kass, is one of the most influential bioethicists of our time and came to be known, during the tenure of George W. Bush, as the president's philosopher. For years after the report was issued, aging research was framed not as a fight against a disease, but as a fight against our humanity. That's hogwash, and in my mind, it's rather deadly hogwash. Yet once the framing has been set, the effort to shift ideas, understandings, and biases becomes a Herculean one. The fight to help people see aging for what it is, rather than just the way it goes, will be a long one. More funding for the kind of research happening in my lab and others like it could bring about these advancements even sooner. But because of a lack of funding, people over 60 today may not live long enough to be helped. If you and your family members end up the last of humanity to live a life that ends all too early with decay and decrepitude, or our children never see the benefits of this research, you can thank those bioethicists. After all of these arguments, if you still think that extending the healthy part of your life would not be for you, perhaps it would reduce your life's urgency or be against the natural course of things, consider your friends and family. Would you subject your loved ones to a decade or two of unnecessary hardship, having to look after you physically, emotionally, and financially in your final years if you didn't have to? Spend a day in a nursing home like my wife does every few days. Go feed people who can't chew. Wipe their bottoms. Bathe them with a sponge. Watch as they struggle to remember where they are and who they are. When you are done, I think you will agree that it would be negligent and cruel for you not to do what you can to combat your own age-related deterioration. There are still a lot of people like Cass out there, but if they live long enough, they will also have to come to terms with reality. The momentum makes the future I have described, or one close to it, unstoppable. Prolonged health spans are inevitable. More and more people recognize this every day, and they want in. Because no matter what people say or believe, whether they are optimists or scaremongers, scientists or bioethicists, there is change in the air. On June 18, 2018, WHO released the 11th edition of the International Classification of Diseases, known as ICD-11. It is a fairly unremarkable document, except that someone slipped in a new disease code. At first, no one saw it. Here is the line, which you can find on the WHO website if you type in code MG2A. It reads, MG2A, old age. Old age without mention of psychosis. Senescence without mention of psychosis. Senile debility. Every country in the entire world is encouraged to start reporting using ICD-11 on January 1st, 2022. What this means is that it is now possible to be diagnosed with a condition called old age. Countries will have to report back to the WHO with their statistics on who dies from aging as a condition. Will this lead to changes at the regulatory level, directing billions of dollars in investment to develop the medicines we deserve? Will federal regulators and doctors finally accept that it is ethically okay to prescribe medicines to slow aging and all the diseases that aging causes? Will they recognize that it is indeed within a patient's rights to receive them? Will insurance companies reimburse patients for the cost of anti-aging treatments that will save money down the line? We will see. I certainly hope the winds build. Until that time comes, though, there is plenty we can do. What I do. Save for eat fewer calories, don't sweat the small stuff, and exercise, I don't give medical advice. I'm a researcher, not a medical doctor. It's not my place to tell anyone what to do, and I don't endorse supplements or other products. I don't mind sharing what I do, though, albeit with some caveats. This isn't necessarily or even likely what you should do. I have no idea if this is even the right thing for me to be doing. While human trials are underway, there are no treatments or therapies for aging that have been through the sort of rigorous long-term clinical testing that would be needed to have a more complete understanding of the wide range of potential outcomes. People often wonder when I tell them things like this, why on earth would I subject myself to the potential for unexpected and adverse side effects or even the possibility, low though it seems to be, that I could expedite my own demise? The answer is simple. I know exactly what's going to happen to me if I don't do anything at all, and it's not pretty. So what do I have to lose? And so, with all that on the table, what do I do? I take 1 gram, 1,000 milligrams of NMN every morning, along with 1 gram of resveratrol, shaken into my homemade yogurt, and 1 gram of metformin. I take a daily dose of vitamin D, vitamin K2, and 83 milligrams of aspirin. I strive to keep my sugar, bread, and pasta intake as low as possible. I gave up desserts at age 40, though I do still taste. I try to skip one meal a day, or at least make it really small. My busy schedule almost always means that I miss lunch most days of the week. Every few months, a phlebotomist comes to my home to draw my blood, which I have analyzed for dozens of biomarkers. When my levels of various markers are not optimal, I moderate them with food or exercise. I try to take a lot of steps each day and walk upstairs, and I go to the gym most weekends with my son, Ben. We lift weights, jog a bit, and hang out in the sauna before dunking in an ice-cold pool. I eat a lot of plants, and I try to avoid eating other mammals, even though they do taste good. If I work out, I will eat meat. I don't smoke. I try to avoid microwaved plastic, excessive UV exposure, X-rays, and CT scans. I try to stay on the cool side during the day and when I sleep at night. I aim to keep my body weight, or BMI, in the optimal range for health span, which for me is 23 to 25. About 50 times a day, I'm asked about supplements. Before I answer, let me say that I never recommend supplements. I don't test or study products, nor do I endorse them. If you see a product implying that I do, it's certainly a scam. Supplements are far, far less regulated than medicines. So if I do take a supplement, I look for a large manufacturer with a good reputation, seek highly pure molecules, more than 98% is a good guide, and look for GMP on the label, which means the product was made under good manufacturing practices. Nicotinamide riboside, or NR, is converted to NMN, so some people take NR instead of NMN because it's cheaper. Cheaper still are niacin and nicotinamide, but they don't seem to raise NAD levels as NMN and NR do. Some people have suggested NAD boosters could be taken with a compound that provides cells with methyl groups, such as methylfolate or trimethylglycine, also known as betaine. Conceptually, this makes sense. The N in NR and NMN stands for nicotinamide, a version of vitamin B3 that the body methylates and excretes in urine when it is in excess, potentially depleting cells of methyls, but this remains a theory. My father follows almost the same regimen as I do, and I can't remember the last time he was sick. He claims he's speeding up. This summer, he left his busy social calendar behind in Australia, and, having helped us with home repairs in Boston for 6 weeks, while working remotely in his second career at the University of Sydney, he then drove around the US East Coast for a few weeks with his lifelong friend on their annual pilgrimage to the Summer Theatre Festival in Worcester, Ohio. Dad flew home at the end of summer, only to come back a few weeks later to see me get knighted, as he called it, in Washington, D.C. Now that he's home in Sydney again, he's planning on driving 600 miles north for a few days to see a couple of friends. He's loving life, seemingly more than he ever has. As I get older, I spend more and more time thinking how lucky I've been in life. As an Aussie, I was taught that big boys don't cry. But nowadays, when I have the time and the sense to pause for a few moments to ponder my life, it's easy to get a little teary. I grew up in a free country, then I moved to an even freer one. I have three amazing children and friends who treat my family like their own. I'm very proud of Sandra, my wife, who was one of the top students in Germany. She aced her botany degree, then came to Boston to be with me, got into the PhD program at MIT, and worked in a lab that was cloning mice for the first time. To earn her PhD, she figured out how to cure mice of a lethal genetic disease called Rett syndrome that disrupts the epigenome and prevents brain development in infant girls. By strange coincidence, the gene she worked on, MECP2, binds to methylated DNA and might be a cellular observer that stores youthful age correction data. Sandra has been teaching me a lot these past 25 years about how to be a better husband and parent, not to mention the names of all the plants, insects, and animals we see on our walks. When we were first married, we argued a lot. She had ethical issues with my research, which pained me. Now, having examined and discussed the wealth of biological and economic data over the years, we no longer argue as much. And in fact, she started taking NMN. It's impossible to say if my regimen is working for us, but it doesn't seem to be hurting. I'm now 50, and I feel the same as I did when I was 30. My heart also looks 30, according to a video of my heart in 3D that one of my colleagues kindly made by inserting me into an experimental magnetic resonance imager. I don't have a gray hair, and I'm not super wrinkly, well, at least not yet. A year ago, my younger brother Nick was going gray and losing his hair when he demanded to be put on the same regimen after accusing me, only half-jokingly, of using him as a negative control. I insisted that I would never do that to my own brother, but I can't say the thought hadn't crossed my mind. He's now on my dad's regimen, too. Living longer makes no sense if you don't have your friends and family around you. Even our three dogs, a small 10-year-old poodle cross named Charlie and 2 3-year-old black Labradors, Katie and Melaleuca, have been put on NMN for a couple of years. Charlie is a therapy dog whose job it is to calm people, but he becomes too hyperactive if Sandra gives him NMN the day he heads to work. So on those days, he's off it. Katie suffers from a congenital kidney defect, and we hope NMN will allow her to make it past her predicted 5-year expiry date. The results of tests in mice with kidney damage say it's possible. A lot of people think a regimen intended to promote prolonged vitality must be hard to stick to. But if it were, my family couldn't do it. We are just an average bunch trying to get through the day. I do live life as mindfully as possible, focus on feeling good, and check my blood markers occasionally. Over time, I've identified the diet, exercise, and supplement routines that work best for me. And I'm confident that my family and I will continue to fine-tune these practices in response to the evolving research as our lives go on, and on, and on. Because yes, I do hope to be here for a long time to come. There are plenty of X factors that could interfere with that goal. I could get hit by a bus tomorrow, after all. But it's getting easier and easier to imagine being around past my 100th year, happy, healthy, and connected to friends, family members, and colleagues. How long past my 100th year? Well, I think it would be nice to see the 22nd century. That would mean making it to my 132nd year. To me, that is a remote chance, but not beyond the laws of biology or way off our current trajectory. And if I do make it that far, perhaps I'll want to stick around even longer. There's so much I want to do, and so many people I'd like to help. I'd love to keep nudging humanity down what I believe is a path to greater health, happiness, and prosperity, and to live long enough to know what path we take. Bushwalking. I recently returned to the neighborhood where I grew up, in the northern suburbs of Sydney, on the edge of Garigal National Park. Dad and Sandra were both there, and so was my 12-year-old son, Benjamin. We'd come for a hike along the trail, the exact same one my grandmother Vera used to take my brother and me on when we were that age. She'd tell us stories about her difficult childhood, about how lucky we were to have grown up in a free country, and about the wisdom of A.A. Milne. "What day is it?" asked Pooh. "It's today," squeaked Piglet. "My favorite day," said Pooh. Dad was raring to go. Ben was too. Tigers, those boys are. But as I stood at the beginning of the trail, on the edge of a high sandstone cliff, overlooking a gully filled with ambrosial eucalyptus and with deafening cicadas overhead, I found myself frozen in awe by the way in which the city quickly gave way to the bush, how the present and the deep past came together, and how it felt to be on the edge of something so vast and so beautiful. If you wind your way south, down the rocky trail leading off Melaleuca Drive, the street I lived on as a boy, you'll reach Middle Harbour, an estuary lined by a canopy of bloodwoods and gophers and scribbly gum trees that ends in Sydney Harbour. If instead you head north, you'll move through hundreds of miles of consecutively larger national parks, Garigal to Ku-ring-gai to Maramara, Darug to Yango to Wollamai, a seemingly endless undulation of saltwater estuaries and craggy mountain ridges decorated by ancient rock carvings. You could walk for days, even for weeks, and not hear anyone save for the distant echoes of the original inhabitants of this land. On that day in Garrigal Park, we were planning on walking only a few hours, but I'd been looking forward to it for weeks. There is, at least to me, a subtle but important difference between hiking and bushwalking. When people hike, they are most often looking for exercise, serenity, beauty, or time together with loved ones. When Australians go for a bushwalk, they are seeking all of those things, but with the intention of finding wisdom too. I'm not sure how long I was standing on the cliff. A minute or two, perhaps. 5 or 10, maybe. However long it was, my family didn't seem to mind. When the spell of nostalgia and wonderment released me, I found them a short way down the trail. Ben was peeling the paper-like bark off a melaleuca tree, while Dad was trying to explain something to him about the cliffs being made of sand that had been deposited when mammals first appeared. Sandra was examining a banksia, the strange, prickly flower Sir Joseph Banks collected to show the Royal Society, which she delighted in reminding us for the umpteenth time is a member of the Proteaceae family. As I write this, Ben is in 7th grade. He's a good boy, a smart boy. He wants to work in my lab someday and take over from me to finish the job. I tell him he'll have a lot of competition and won't get any special treatment from me. And he says, well, if that's true, I can always work for Lenny Garanti. Yes, he's a funny boy too. Our two older children are making their own paths. Natalie, I reckon, as a veterinarian. Alex, perhaps, as a diplomat or a politician. Dad is now 80, the age his mother Vera was when the fire in her eyes had completely gone. She had lost the will to live and never ventured outside again. I cannot predict the future, but when I look at the full life Dad leads now, his world travel, his optimism, and the state of his health, I think he'll be around for a long time to come. I sure hope he will. Not just because he represents hope for all of us, but because I'd like to come back to this place again and again with Dad and Sandra and all those I love, searching for serenity, hearing stories, finding beauty, making memories, sharing wisdom. With Ben and Natalie and Alex, yes, but also with their children and with their children's children. Why not? Nothing is inevitable. This is David Sinclair.
And this is Matthew LaPlante.
Assuming you didn't skip through these conversations, we hope you found them valuable.
And one of the things we hope you'll do is continue to have these conversations with your friends and your family and your colleagues.
Yeah, and we hope this book has given you the background you need to understand and talk about the science of aging and to be a little more informed when talking to your medical providers about decisions that will impact your lifespan and health span and those of your loved ones.
And we also want you to think about the implications. If you're going to live to see a world in which humans live much longer and much healthier lives, what do you want that world to look like?
Yeah, it's really a choice. We all have a choice. And it's a choice we're all going to have to make, individually and together as a society and as a planet. None of us can afford to sit on the sidelines.
So thanks for listening.
And keep in touch.
Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To, was written and read by David A. Sinclair with Matthew D. LaPlante. It was recorded at Mix One Studios Incorporated in Boston by Adam Weiss and at 48 Windows in Santa Monica by Scott Crisp. Post-production by Hudson Sound. The associate producer was Claire Tatacoro. Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To, was produced and directed by Karen Perlman with Travis Tunn. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. Lifespan, Why We Age and Why We Don't Have To, is available in print from Atria Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.